Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. At the end of the show, I'll be talking with James Beard award-winning Portland chef, Naomi Pomeroy. This past fall, Naomi released the cookbook Taste and Technique. We'll talk about her new book as well as her history with cooking. At the beginning of February, Organicology will be held in downtown Portland. Organicology brings together stakeholders in the organics industry for 3 days of networking and information sharing. I'll be talking with Tanya Hayworth, one of the conference organizers, who will give us a preview of this year's conference. Even though it's cold outside and we've had snow lately, we're still going to have our monthly conversation with Marisha Auerbach about what to do in the garden. But first, in a season when many people will be gathering together to share meals, hunger and food insecurity remains a huge problem in the state of Oregon. From 2012 to 2014, 16.1% of Oregonians experienced food insecurity. When faced with these grave numbers, a group of people who have a deep connection with food decided to do something about it.
It says on your website that Farmers Ending Hunger,
farmers from around the state came together to create Farmers Ending Hunger. I recently talked with the executive director of Farmers Ending Hunger, John Burt, about the mission of the organization and what it is doing to address hunger in Oregon.
Food insecurity. And every year, the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, does a survey of food insecurity in each state. And 12 years ago, Oregon ranked number one in the country in food insecurity. Made front page news. People were talking about it. The governor at the time, Kuligowski, talking about it. And our board chair and founder, Fred Ziari, went to a meeting about that time at Oregon Food Bank. And he found out about this, and he's a smart guy, and he says, you know, I didn't even know about this. And further, he's involved in agriculture, and he says, I really didn't know about it. He said, so he's the kind of guy that when he sees something, he gets after it. And he thought, well, what could I do? What could we do about that? And he basically, you know, the short story is he came to the conclusion, who better to feed hungry people than farmers? And so he started talking to his farmer clients and friends and got a pretty positive response. So that was back in about 2004, 2005, they really first. So, you know, it's been going on. We've been at it 10 years now. But it was that was the response. It was somebody took action when faced with, we're number one in food insecurity.
That's great. And I want to talk more about what you guys do at Farmers Ending Hunger. But let's dig into hunger a little bit more.
Yeah.
What do you think are the root causes of hunger?
Bottom line is it's economics. People don't have enough money to make it through the end of the month and buy food all the time. I think there's a misperception that the root causes are people that are just habitually on food stamps, they're feeding from the trough, they're not working, they're not. About 70% of the people, the families that are getting a food box, somebody in the family's working, employed. It's the bulk of the people are the working poor, you might categorize. Single parents, single women parents are the most rapidly rising food insecure part of the population. So you're in that income situation where anything comes up. You got a car repair bill, a doctor, dental bill, you know, the rent's got to be paid, the utilities got to be paid. The one thing you don't have to spend money on is food. And so people will choose, parents especially, will feed the kids but choose to do without. And when that circumstance happens to someone, they know that and will become aware and they're faced with the option of going to the food bank. And so, you know, income would solve a lot of things. There's some people that I think are always, a segment of the population is always going to have an issue. You lost your job, you've been injured, things happen for whatever, you know, kind of calamity that is a financial issue. And, I mean, you can notice the homelessness and the homeless population right now that beyond people's circumstances, they need help. But the bottom line for the majority of people, it's strictly economics.
Food is so universal. Food
yeah.
is a right. And it seems like farmers, of all people, are the people who understand that. So I want to talk a little bit about Farmers Ending Hunger. What exactly are Farmers Ending Hunger doing to help end hunger?
The basic premise that it started on was that we would ask farmers to donate a portion of their harvest, basically, set aside a percentage or an acre, and have it come right out of harvest. It's pre-planned. It's a definitive, purposeful donation. It isn't just an accident. And for the most part, it's happened that way. We ask farmers and ranchers, cattle also, growers, to sort of set this up and have it become more of an ongoing year-to-year program. And so the response has been pretty tremendous. You know, we started out small, and we've grown. It's 10 years now, but the response has been pretty good. And we, in 2015, the farmers and ranchers donated about a little over 4.2 million pounds of stuff, fresh products, potatoes, onions, livestock were donated, wheat that's made into pancake mix, and vegetables, processed and fresh, so all of that added up, and we're a little less than that. Some donations went down, just depends on the circumstances of some of the producers, but we're going to be between 3 and 4 million pounds again this year, and so the response has been pretty good. We try to ensure that it's going to be high quality, and it's coming right out of harvest, the same as anything you and I might find in a grocery store.
And what does that translate into as far as the families that receive the food? How many people are benefiting from this program?
Well, we just delivered 216,000 pounds of baking mix, which can be made into muffins or pancakes, and it seems like that's a few million servings of, if it's pancakes or muffins or whatever. They're in 3-pound bags when we finally get it there to the food bank. And so that's just one example. Every month we have 22 head of cattle donated, and that's made into hamburger. Sourced proteins hard to come by at the food bank, and so it's a hamburger. So we have each is a 3-pound, they call it a tub. It's a tube of hamburger like you see in the store. And 3 pounds is like a quarter pound is a serving of protein, so that's 12 servings. So at 12, that's times 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of hamburger each month. That might be 60,000 servings monthly of protein. So that's kind of how that equates. The food bank has a conversion factor that I'm not familiar with of what pounds convert into food boxes. The Oregon Food Bank, in the last 2 years, has delivered a little over a million food boxes in Oregon. So even though we generate, you know, 1 million pounds of onions or 2 million pounds of potatoes, that's not putting a whole lot in all those million food boxes. So we got a ways to go. But those are the kinds of products, and the impact is of ours, of course. It's the kind of things you want to see in a food box. So we're really pretty happy with the way that works.
Could you talk a little bit more about your relationship with the Oregon Food Bank? It sounds like they provide that sort of distribution infrastructure, but what's that relationship like?
Oh, it's definitely a partnership. We could not do what we do without Oregon Food Bank, Oregon Food Bank Network. There's the Oregon Food Bank in Portland, serves the metro area, and then there are 20 regional food banks throughout Oregon, and then the one in Clark County, Washington, Vancouver, that is the distribution network. They have a distribution agreement. There are set percentages of statewide donations that go out to the network, and so they do the transportation, warehousing, redistribution, get it out to the regional food banks. It's a great model. And we obviously, we couldn't do anything we're doing, really. Some things get delivered directly sometimes, but for the most part, you know, we don't have farmers any hunger, we don't have any warehouses, we don't have any trucks other than we'll hire trucking, or sometimes the farmers or ranchers will provide trucking, but we rely totally on Oregon Food Bank, and they just do a great job, just fantastic.
So farming is a low-margin profession, so it seems like to donate, it's kind of asking a lot of farmers, what do the farmers get from participating with Farmers Ending Hunger?
Well, bottom line, the state of Oregon 3 years ago reinstituted a tax credit for donations. So there is in Oregon, for Oregon taxes only, a 15% tax credit for the wholesale value of the product that's donated. So that will provide some cents on the, you know, on the pound, and it might provide enough of an incentive for the grower to get the harvest crew out or to move it out of a warehouse, those kind of things. There are federal deductions depending on your corporate structure and amounts that can be donated, but it's a deduction, not a tax credit. So Oregon's a little bit in the lead on that and providing that tax credit. And I don't know for sure if it helped with the last couple of years, but it may have provided some incentive to get more product. I've never had a grower ask me when I've talked to him about this, what are the tax consequences, John? That's never come up in the equation. And I've had several of the donor, you know, farmers, ranchers, on camera, in front of a TV camera, being asked, so why do you do this? And the bottom line that always comes through is, well, because it's the right thing to do. And of anybody out there, farmers get feeding hungry people. There's no question.
How can people get involved with Farmers Ending Hunger?
We have a program we call Adopt an Acre. And what that does is we get the product donated, and there's still some things we need to do to it. We need to get it sometimes processed. We need to get it into a form and shape and package and size that'll fit in a food box. And so we try to cover all of those costs before it gets to Oregon Food Bank. We do that through donations of the Adopt an Acre program from the public and from businesses that help us that way. And so we, on our website, farmersendinghunger.com, we're a nonprofit, a 501c3, but we ended up with .com, not .org. So farmersendinghunger.com, www.farmersendinghunger.com, or contact us, info@farmersendinghunger.com, email, those ways of communication. I'm the only person, so you send in an email, it comes to me. So there's no confusion there. And the website, pretty straightforward. We have a donation page if people want to help out. We're got pretty good leverage. And for any dollar that's donated, creates multiple pounds of food getting into the food bank because of the quantities that get generated. You know, just off an acre of corn is 10 tons, an acre of green beans is 6 tons. It adds up in a hurry, and so pretty good leverage. But that's how we'd like people to get involved. They can sign up on the webpage also. We have an e-newsletter we don't send out very often, about quarterly, with information and contact and what we're doing. And some on our website, there's also some farmer profiles. They can learn about some of the farmers that are donating and find out about us that way. And then if you'd like, get on our email newsletter.
In sort of these uncertain times, we really need programs like this where people are taking care of people. So thank you very much for coming on the show and talking with me about Farmers Ending Hunger.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me, and best holiday wishes and safe travels for everybody through the winter. And we really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was John Burt, the executive director of Farmers Ending Hunger. In a moment, we'll have a preview of the upcoming Organicology Conference. I'll be talking with Tanya Hayworth, one of the organizers. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. Every other year, Portland is host to Organicology, a conference that brings together people from all facets of the organic industry. The next Organicology is going to be held the first weekend in February. To give us a preview of what to expect at the upcoming conference, I talked with Tanya Hayworth, one of the conference organizers.
So what is Organicology?
Well, Organicology is a three-day biennial conference held in Portland, Oregon. It is put on by four organizations. Organically Grown Company is the largest Northwest wholesale distributor of organic produce. Oregon Tills, a nonprofit certifying agency located in Corvallis. Along with the Organic Seed Alliance, located up in Washington, and the Sustainable Food Trade Association. And the conference has been put on every other year since 2009, when our company had previously done a vendor fair every year, and we were reached out to by some of these other organizations about combining our efforts and kind of really amping up the conversations happening within the organic agriculture sector. So that's how it was born.
Who are the people that you're trying to bring together with Organicology?
We are bringing together anybody with a stake in the organic food and seed and policy and research, eaters. We're bringing anybody who has a stake in the agricultural and food side of our world today.
Who's coming to the conference? Is it just people from the area, or is it people from all over?
No, yeah, we have folks. We've had folks travel as far away as a lot of folks from Mexico. We have Arizona. We have growers on the East Coast. Seed producers, researchers. We have, I believe, we even had a kiwi farmer from New Zealand 1 year join us. And in 2015, we had approximately 1,200 attendees. So, all across our globe.
So it's a diverse range of people. I want to talk about some of the conversations that are had, and we'll talk about the keynote speakers in a minute. But what are some of the conversations? What are some of the focuses that people are talking about at Organicology?
The conference is laid out over 3 days. And so Thursday, we have some day-long intensives, and those are where you're really getting down deep on certain topics. And then Friday, smaller time frames. We have workshops all day, and then Saturday is our trade show. So some of the topics that we're going to be discussing on Thursday, including the transition happening in the organic growth sector, which involves the succession planning for a lot of the people that started the organic movement are to retirement age, which whether they work on a farm or they're working, in our industry, in wholesale or processing or what have you. And with that, another conversation is going to be the case for independence in the organic trade. You know, there's a lot of organizations that have maybe dabbled in organic or had an organic line and are seeing, that the trends within consumers are heading that way. And so that means that there's a lot of smaller companies being bought up. So really having these, these real conversations about what that means and how to remain independent. Organic farm business management, working with these new farmers as they come in to, an industry and a trade that has, very deep roots and ties and, what it looks like for them going forward, in this new landscape. Leasing land is expensive and transitioning just, the knowledge of the folks who started this trade. Additionally, on Friday in some of our workshops, we have topics such as, farm biological, managing organic integrity, selling to the masses, organics in Mexico. We're going to be talking about celebrating seeds, climate change, variety trials, marketing fair trade products. It's a really, really wide group of topics that we spent a lot of time as a team, refining and defining and trying to determine what folks are the most passionate about right now in the world that we live in.
So one of the draws to Organicology is the keynote speakers. You guys usually get some pretty exciting keynote speakers, and that's the same this year. Could you tell us a little bit about the keynote speakers that are going to be speaking at the conference?
Certainly. One of my favorite people, his name is Masumoto, will be speaking. His topic is changing season and the ties that bind generations, disruption, and farming. Moss is an organic peach and grape farmer down in California, and he is also an author. Him and his daughter run the farm, and they one of their most prized books is their family farm cookbook called The Perfect Peach that was released in 2013. But Moss is just one of the warmest and kindest people you'll meet, and a great speaker, and we're really looking forward to having him up here. Our second keynote speaker is a gentleman named Eric Holt Jimenez, and his topic is food sovereignty, transforming the food system. Eric is the executive director of Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, which is hailed as one of the most established food think tanks by the New York Times. So we're also very excited to have Eric join us. And, food justice, food and social justice is a huge focus of what we're talking about at Organicology, which leads me to our third speaker, Nikki Silvestri of People's Grocery. And she's also the co-founder and CEO of Silvestri Strategies. She does a lot of project design and management work with communities, economies, and is the co-founder of Live Real. And she's going to be speaking about economic development and climate beneficial agriculture and how to make it work for all people. If you've never seen Nikki speak, I definitely wouldn't miss her. She's a great, great one.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to all three of those speakers. One thing that I do enjoy about Organicology is the food, and I'm always impressed by it. How do you source and put together the meals?
That's one of the fun tasks I work on. We have a lot of committees, as you can imagine, putting together a conference like this. We have a logistics team and a food team, and we actually have a whole group of folks working on that. And specifically how we do it is kind of, it changes every year, and I like to think that we're redefining and getting better at what we do. A lot of our products that are used, our event is at the Hilton, and their chef there is great. He is accommodating because we're bringing in all this weird organic stuff for him to process. But they've said that we're actually one of their favorite conferences to cook for because we have such an exciting menu. And we receive a lot of donations from farms. We also, we'll sell stuff through our company. We're obviously an organic produce wholesaler, so we have access to stuff. And then we have a pretty strict, might not be the right word, but we have told them to work with us on sourcing everything organically. So that's not traditional for hotels, and so we have been working on it for the past few years. And last year, I think all the way down to the salt and pepper, they were working to source organically. And then, you know, getting everything there, we've got a lot of trucks and a lot of bodies around here, so it's definitely a combined effort. And one of the most intriguing meals that we put together on Friday night focuses on using ingredients sourced through the Slow Food List and the Arc of Taste. So we have some really, really exciting and kind of rare varieties that will be all showcased in our Friday night menu.
There's a lot of information sharing that's going to be happening. There's the workshops, intensives, the speakers, but there's also the trade show. Can you describe the trade show for the listeners?
Sure. Well, I always like to say that the trade show is my baby. As I said, OGC, we had done vendor fairs before, so those were basically how the trade show portion of this was born. It is small and large is the way I like to think about it. It is one of the most lively and engaging group of vendors and folks in there. When you walk down the ramp and you're immediately looking at a booth that has, you know, 27 different kinds of citrus next to somebody with 150 different varieties of beautiful organic seed next to a leaf and chard grower, and then you have folks that are doing soil management. We have a organic tortilla company that kind of got a lift, you know, the first time they're at Organicology. The next, you know, a few months later, I saw their tortillas in New Seasons, you know. So it's people, it's just the best cross-pollination of folks talking about every component of the, you know, the organic supply line and trade that you can imagine. It is fun. I mean, that's probably the best way to describe it. It is usually rocking when you get down there. Lots of great conversation and commingling happening.
Oh yeah, it's lively, and that's one of the things I enjoy most is the amount of conversations you can have with so many different people. So we're about out of time, but I do want to give you a chance to actually give the details for Organicology, the where's and when's and whatnots.
Sure. So you can register for the conference and sign up to be an exhibitor if you're interested in exhibiting on organicology.org. And the conference takes place at the downtown Portland Hilton on February 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of 2017.
Tanya, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Chris.
That was Tanya Hayworth from Organically Grown Company with a preview of Organicology. You can find a link to more information about Organicology on the Food Show page of the KBOO website. In a moment, we'll have our monthly segment with permaculturist Marisha Auerbach, where we talk about the garden. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. At this point in the season, we've experienced snow covering roads as well as the brassicas out in the garden. The work outside is slow, but there are still things that you can do to improve your garden space. To talk about some winter garden tasks, I'm joined by Marisha Auerbach.
So the first frost was a long time coming, but it did finally hit us. With the temperatures so low, what should we be doing to protect plants that are still in the garden?
Gosh, that first frost was more than a month later, so, and it's finally good that we got it. So some people might have areas that they've decided to put a cold frame, and that's protecting plants from the cold weather. I like to have some blankets near the back door just in case to throw out on plants that don't want to be as cold. Also, making sure that your garden is nicely mulched will help protect plants from frost. I've noticed that I've had carrots in the ground that when they don't have mulch on them in the winter, the tops will start to decompose. And when they do have mulch on them, you'll have really nice carrots right underneath the mulch. So all you got to do is pull it back. I like to use leaves, and I'll tend to top all of my root vegetables with leaves to protect them in the frost.
What else can we do to protect the soil throughout the winter?
Yeah, mulching is the top thing to do to prevent compaction. You don't really want to walk on your garden beds during the winter. You never really want to walk on your garden beds to protect the soil colloids and prevent compaction.
Although it feels like right now with the how frozen it is, that walking is not going to do that much.
Well, you know, if you walk on something that's a pretty aerated bed, you still could get quite a footprint in the center of that bed. So if anyone wants to see what I mean, they should just go out there and try it.
And the cold weather, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Does it do anything positive for the plants that are in the garden?
I love this cold weather, and I've been really looking forward to it. Some plants are even better with the cold. Like your kales will get better. Brussels sprouts get better with frost. By now, because it's so late, we've harvested our rose hips or your grapes, but those often are supposed to be harvested after the frost. You know what I'm really looking forward to with the frost, and I hope that we get cold weather for at least 2 weeks for this, is we really need those aphids and whiteflies to be knocked back. We've had a number of years without prolonged cold weather, and the populations of these insects have really expanded. And as our summers have gotten hotter, I think a lot of people are seeing impacts from the aphids and the whiteflies on their brassicaceae plants in the garden.
So along with the cold, we're getting hit with some wind as well. What can people do to deal with the effects of wind?
You know, wind is something that I consider in long-term planning. If your house is exposed to wind, it might mean that you pay more money in your heating bills. It could be that if your animals are exposed to wind, that it increases their food costs, that they eat more because they're cold. So designing for wind could be considering how to protect those spaces from the wind and create microclimates of shelter to be able to do more in a space.
So I know that this season has pretty much come to an end, and not completely, because there are still things that are growing in the garden, still plants that we're going to be able to harvest from. But my brain wants to start thinking about next season. Have you started planning for the coming year?
Yeah, I'm always planning for the year ahead. I like to hunker down around winter solstice and spend some time with intentional planning. In that planning, I'm planning for my workshop series coming up for 2017, which goes once a month from February through November. And it highlights what to do each month in the garden. But I always, in the winter, I like to reflect on the layout of the garden to see if I want to change anything. I do a lot of composting. I like to document my successes and reflect on my challenges, and especially when there's been a specific plant or species that's given me trouble, you know, what can I do that better? Where would be the better microclimate for it to go in? Or, you know, how can I get even more raspberries than last year, or strawberries, or whatever that might be?
I definitely know that I'm guilty of not doing that in the past, and then you know the same problem will happen year after year just because I don't have a record of it. So that seems like a great thing right now. When it's cold outside, you can sit inside and write down some of your thoughts from the previous season.
Yeah, yeah. I'm actually working on a garden journal that's going to gonna include what to do in the permaculture landscape throughout the year, including the vegetable garden, the berry bushes, medicinal herbs, you know, having a mushroom patch, all of that, so that it's the month by month what to do and provide space for reflections and jotting down your notes for each year. One thing I love doing in the winter is looking over the seed catalogs. And I just want to emphasize for gardeners who are ready to start planning for the coming year, the importance of growing heirloom seeds that have been adapted for our area. Often I find that gardeners have trouble with a specific vegetable crop, or they just can't seem to grow, you know, whatever that might be. And when we grow varieties that are selected for our environment, then those are plants that have been grown out year after year after year for doing well in our climate. And they're more adaptable to the changes that we might have. So we have some really great local seed companies: Wild Garden Seed, Adaptive Seeds, Siskiyou Seeds, Uprising Seeds. All of these seed companies provide heirloom varieties that are adapted for our area. And so those are good places to go if you're looking for seeds that will do well and be reliable in your home garden here in Portland. And I think for next year, I'm going to be expanding my vegetable plant nursery to also include a bit of a CSA program for people who are interested in just getting the starts that they need every month. So beginning in April, customers will get one flat of vegetable starts each month, so they don't really have to think about all those different varieties and can just plant what they want to and grow some reliable plants.
So you mentioned that you're planning your workshops. What do you have any workshops or classes coming up?
Well, we're going to be starting the Oregon State University online permaculture design course in January. So that's an online program that goes for 10 weeks. And I get to actually overlap courses and go to Belize in late February. I run a permaculture design course in the south of Belize. It's in a really remote area that's, you can only reach it by foot or by a dugout canoe. So there's no cars that come within, 45 minutes of this space. It's at the Maya Mountain Research Farm, and we work with traditional Mayan farmers and Garifuna farmers who live in the area, as well as internationals can come and join us. So if anyone's looking for a vacation to Belize to learn about permaculture and be in the heart of the Mayan cacao growing country, where many of our other favorite tropical plants are grown, like vanilla and coffee and cardamom and turmeric, come join me in Belize.
Marisha, thank you so much for braving the weather and the cold and joining me on the food show.
Thanks for having me here, Chris.
That was permaculturist Marisha Auerbach. For more information about the classes Marisha offers, you can visit her website, permaculturerising.com, or head on over to the food show page of the KBOO website. Coming up, I'll be talking with James Beard award-winning chef Naomi Pomeroy about her cookbook, Taste and Technique. You're listening to the food show on KBOO. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. Have you ever wondered how they make food look and taste so good at fine dining restaurants? Naomi Pomeroy, chef and owner of Beast in Portland, has recently given us a peek behind the scenes. In her new cookbook, Taste and Technique, Naomi methodically details how you can take your home cooking to the next level. I recently talked with Naomi about the cookbook and her life in the world of food.
When did you first start cooking?
Gosh, that is the very beginning. I guess I started when I was a little kid, when I was tall enough to be able to stand on a step stool and reach the counter is really when it started happening, and wanted to help my mom cook dinner, breakfast, dinner, and lunch. It was always a constant conversation in our house. What are we having? What's next? What are you doing? Can I help you? And so it started early, and then it just kind of continued on from there. I have had jobs outside of the cooking industry, but only I worked at a jewelry store for my dad when I was a teenager. But otherwise, all my jobs have been in restaurants and delis and catering and cafes and the like. So, and I'm 42, so it's been a while.
So you've cooked for people for a while. What is it that draws you to cooking for people?
Oh gosh, I really think that there's a combination of things that has to happen in order for someone to be a successful chef. And some of those things are healthy things, like the spirit of wanting to give and care for people. Others of those things are a little bit more maybe personality traits, like wanting to hide in the background a little bit, wanting to do something from a distance. I can be very gregarious as a person, and that's the sharing and caring part. But then there's this other private part where I sort of like to be in control and doing my own thing and on the sidelines in the background. And being a chef is kind of all of those things. And so it just fits.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty intimate to be able to like feed somebody. So you got to have this kind of powerful interaction, but you can step back.
It is. I think it's interesting at Beast, my restaurant over in Northeast Portland. You know, I've been behind the counter there for 9 years, and it's gotten easier. At first, I feel like it was it's very exposing. It's almost like, you know, when you're creating something that's from your heart and your spirit, and you're putting something on the table for someone to consume. You know, most restaurants or a lot of restaurants, you can't see the people eating. But at Beast, it's totally an open kitchen space. And so we can see everything. We can see people talking. We can see people laughing. We can see if they're enjoying. We can see if they're maybe not eating it, you know. And then those reasons could be manifold. They don't like a particular thing, or they're just engaged in conversation. And it took a long time for me to sort of get out of my head and realize that, you know, whatever was happening was okay. Trust the process. But it's a little bit like being an artist in an art gallery, standing behind someone, looking at your painting and talking about it. So it's interesting.
And how often does that lead to conversations with the people who are eating?
Oh, a lot. I mean, that's my favorite thing about having an open kitchen is really the dialogue that can happen. It doesn't have to happen. It doesn't feel like it, you know, people don't feel like they're required to come and talk to me, or I don't feel the same about them. But if someone has a question, or they're inspired by something, or they have a suggestion, or even if I hear them, sometimes I can just hear them saying like, wow, this beef is really good. I wonder where we could get this beef. And I'll just step out from behind the butcher block and have a conversation with someone about it.
So you mentioned Beast, and you've run some supper clubs that create sort of an intimate dining experience. Why focus on feeding small groups of people? Why not try to feed as many people as possible?
Oh, wow. I think that that's a really important question, especially right now in the climate of restaurants and growth here in Portland. I don't know, why not have a radio, you know, why not have a radio station that's a huge conglomerate, you know? Well, because you don't get to touch it in the same way. And for me, it's a spirituality of what we do. I know that sounds a little bit cheesy, but it's like I love to feel like I'm actually in contact with things. And, you know, even if I'm not working at the restaurant every night, which I don't anymore, and I'm proud of the fact that I get to spend time with my family now, I still have a hand in being there every day and tasting through the food and all that stuff. And I feel like if I grew too much, I wouldn't be able to, you know, have that same touch, the same, you know, ability to say to someone like, oh, that soup just needs a little bit more lemon in it, you know? And I think that when you have many establishments, those people are very successful financially, and that's awesome. But sometimes I think that you can't keep as close of an eye on it, or you're constantly just dealing with management and things like that. Whereas if I have a small staff, I have a small room. Beast is an 800 square foot restaurant, and I run a cocktail bar across the street with my husband called Expatriate, and that's the same size. So I have two really tiny places. We can fit like 25 to 30 people in each establishment, and it's just a size that I like, you know. It's not a super profitable size, but it's a size that I feel like I can get a handle on. I can know my customers, and I can have some intimate dialogue.
I guess if you've created these spaces where you're going to have to exist, you're going to be there a lot, you might as well create them in a way that you want to be there.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that was the original kind of, you asked about supper clubs and doing the underground kind of dining scene. You know, it's called pop-up. They're called pop-ups now, but there wasn't even a name for them when we started back in 2000, when our daughter was born. And it was really just this idea that we would be creating community, a community of people that all wanted to, they didn't have to have the same ideals. It was just about sharing a meal together. And actually, I am part of this foreign diplomacy initiative. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she started something called the Culinary Diplomacy Initiative. And basically, it uses chefs as diplomats in foreign countries. So I've traveled several times to Hong Kong, to Thailand, and just sharing food, teaching, and doing some cross-cultural exchange, which is another part of my job that I'm really interested in.
That's amazing. So you've gotten to both, I'm assuming, give and take in that relationship. I'm sure you receive a lot from those experiences.
I do, yeah. And I'm also sort of a trap. If I could do anything else besides be a chef or a florist, I guess I would be a permanent travel junkie or have a travel show or something like that. You know, I love it. I love those experiences.
So I want to kind of get, you know, transition over to the cookbook. It sounds like from reading your bio that cookbooks were a major part of your culinary education. What does it mean for you to now have your own published cookbook?
It was something that I toyed around with for a while, like the idea of doing that. But the timing wasn't right. In 2010, I think I sort of started the conversation, and then I dropped it for a while and focused back on the restaurant and, you know, got a James Beard Award and, you know, kind of did a bunch of, like, legacy work, kind of. But, you know, I decided I wanted to write this book because I really feel like there's something missing in our culture about, like, if you read old cookbooks from, like, the 40s and 50s and 60s, there is an assumption that happened where people, like, if they would say things like, roll the dough out and then bake in a hot oven. And those recipes could be short because everybody knew that stuff. There was still a generational language that was happening where, you know, grandmothers and grandfathers were passing down tradition to people. And I think something happened when we started going to convenience culture and, you know, junk food and all of the stuff that people relied on heavily when I was a child, you know, older child, like when I was middle school and high school and stuff like that. And I found that people are losing the language for how to do things. And so what I wanted to do with this book is really put that back into play and go back sort of to the beginning and explain, you know, what it means to blend something until it's completely smooth, and how do you know, and what consistency are you looking for? And I was inspired by a lot of books that I read growing up. So the biggest one, probably when I think about how this book, Taste and Technique, is organized, it's organized by chapter, by single subject chapter. So it's like, it's pretty classically organized. Like the first chapter is sauces, and then we go into appetizers and soups and salads. And I think that came to me from some inspiration from the Time Life Books for Cooks series. And for those of you who might not know what that is, you can Google it. And sometimes you can see old copies of it at Powell's. They're each about 3/4 of an inch wide and single subject. So there's one on eggs, one on poultry, desserts, cakes. And so it's just a really interesting window in. And each of those recipes had photographs and descriptions, and it would be like, you know, this is what the egg whites look when you first start whipping them, and this is exactly what they look like when they're all the way whipped. And so I took some inspiration from that and really want to share with people to sort of unwrap the secrets of why food is better in restaurants, or why, you know, why do we go out to eat and why are we impressed, kind of, and then being able to take that at home and use those techniques to build your own cooking repertoire.
I think you call them the building blocks in the book, that kind of gives people the building blocks to actually recreate some of these foods.
Exactly. So I think it's important, you know, to know that every time you start a braise, you start by, you know, pre-seasoning your meat and then searing it in a really hot pan, and then a certain amount of liquid, and this is how you know when it's done. And you can use that technique on, you know, braising any meat, for example, if you eat meat, or, you know, there's technique in here about how to properly dress a salad. And that seems so simple, but it is something that is very specific, and you know when you've done it wrong and you know when you've done it right. And this book helps understand why.
You kind of touched on this, but there might be people who find the idea of cooking something that they could potentially be served at a restaurant like Beast intimidating. So what do you have to say to those people?
Well, I did design it so that the instructions are so specific that I think as long as you know, my recommendation is always just to read the recipe all the way through once, and then to gather all the ingredients, you know, via the list. So just in small dishes and bowls, just collect all of the ingredients and kind of get the prep started. And then it's really just about following the directions and assembling it. So I have said before that I think a very ambitious 12-year-old could probably make any of the recipes in this book. And that should give people the feeling of confidence. And we tested these recipes many, many times specifically so that people would walk away saying like, wow, I got something out of that because I did it and it worked. And I had a huge compliment the other day. I was in Los Angeles doing a dinner and we were doing a book dinner, you know, of recipes from the book. And I had other events right up to that, so I had to have a different chef actually prepare the meal for me so that I could just sort of show up. And, you know, he just gave me the biggest compliment. He's this chef that I totally respect, and he said, I just want to say that, you know, I've helped write cookbooks, and I've used a lot of recipes in my life, and he just said all of these recipes that I used worked so well. I didn't have to change anything. I mean, even the seasoning and the salt and everything we measure, and it was all right on. So that was a huge compliment, and I think that audience people that are wondering, you know, what book to buy for Christmas this year should think about that, because I think it's they're specific and you'll be successful.
So that is a good, that kind of leads to the person who's going to be using this book cookbook. Who is Taste and Technique meant for?
Oh, I think that I design Taste and Technique, like maybe it's not for professional chefs, although a lot of professional chefs have said that they enjoy it a lot because it's pretty comprehensive and detailed. I mean, I do think that it's more for home cooks, probably that have, well, at least a passion. I don't think you have to have like a specific time frame of skills. You know, I don't think you have to have been cooking for X number of years or, you know, been able to make puff pastry before by hand or, you know, whatever it is. Like, I think that passion and interest are like 95% of the equation. And passion and interest and then just practice. So it is like, you know, and one of the things that we emphasize in the book is like, you know, we talk about making a souffle, for example, because that was a symbolic thing that I learned to make as a young kid. When I was writing this cookbook, I realized I ate a lot of souffles as a kid and that I thought, wow, that's a great thing. It's kind of fallen out of fashion. It's a great thing to teach people to do. It involves technique, but it's got ingredients that pretty much everyone has around in their kitchen, eggs, flour, butter, cheese, milk, you know, it's like pretty simple and any kind of vegetable. So I talked about that and I called my mom and I said, Mom, you know, I'm going to write a souffle recipe for the book. And, you know, can you remind me sort of how, you know, what recipes you referred to so I could kind of make a cross-referencing. She started laughing at me. She said, you don't need a recipe for souffle. It's just, you know, one cup of milk to five eggs or whatever she said. And I realized in that moment that it is, you can use a recipe, but recipes, you know, eventually after you practice something enough, they become just like reference points and ratios and a guideline. but I did write that recipe and I tested it many, many, many times. But I say in the book, and it's true, that if your souffle doesn't rise all the way the first time you make it, you can figure out what you did wrong and it's still a delicious meal. So I think that that's sort of the takeaway is, you'll get better at all these things. And these are building blocks that will help you become more confident because the recipes really work.
I think that's one of the things that I really appreciated about the cookbook. When I got it, I immediately made the roasted beet salad with frisée and creme fraiche. And, you know, it didn't look like the restaurant, you know, it didn't look like the picture. Mm-hmm. It was close. Okay. I'll give myself a little bit of credit. It was close. But the recipes in here are just so flavor forward that regardless of what you make, it is going to be delicious. And I think that's part of the conversation that is going on between producers of food is that this focus on flavor and sort of this is a vehicle for making more flavorful food.
Yeah, people. Of course. And of course, the vehicle starts with using the best product, right? So we're very lucky to live in Portland and to have access to, maybe not at this time of year so much, but there's great produce purveyors and farmers locally. And people in Portland are committed. They're like, they're at the farmer's market, even in the rain, and they're learning about how to pare down artichokes from the artichoke farmer. And, you know, I think that people are active, involved, and that's why Portland is such a great place to live. I think that one of the things that is unique about this book is that I was doggedly determined to make sure that there was a photograph for every single recipe. And I know that for myself, over years of looking at other cookbooks, I mean, I have cookbooks that don't have any pictures in them, and I have cookbooks that have every other or every third recipe has a picture. And when you don't have a picture, you don't necessarily know what you're aiming for. So I was just happy to hear you say that you made it kind of look like the picture, which, you know, freedom of expression, you know, make it however you want it to make it. But it's nice to have a reference point, because I think that one of the things that people at home don't do that restaurant cooks do is really focus on what a plate looks like, because we do eat with our eyes first. And I think it's just something that if home cooks paid like a teeny bit more attention to, you know, like even a little garnish flourish, it seems silly, but even when I make like a simple pasta for my husband at home, I'm still chopping up a little parsley to sprinkle over the top. And it's, you know, it's for flavor, but it's also just because it's bright and green and beautiful. And I think it's something that's really important, and not to skip that part.
Yeah. Well, and that's in our brains. I mean, the experience dictates how we taste food. And so, yeah, the more you take those little steps, I know for me, I enjoy meals more when I add that little flourish.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like, it's also sort of that thing that says, I care. You know, it says like, I went out into the garden and I found these little leaves and I like tossed them in a little oil and vinegar and I tucked them into the side of this roasted chicken or whatever. And it does seem kind of silly, but it's sort of like arranging flowers, which is my other big obsession. There's something that's just, when you can spend a little time, slow your mind down, it's like a meditation. You're giving one more like step of thought to something, and it really does show that you care.
So last question, this is kind of, we're going to go a little bit big on this, but you've been cooking for years now. How do you stay inspired?
Okay, I would say that right now in my career, I am thinking a lot about what's next all the time. So, you know, for I guess the first 7 years of Beast, I was there like every single day and writing every menu and like serving every plate of food. And over time, I've realized that if I want to create balance in my life, which I'm really committed to, I have to put a team of people in there that can do it even if I'm not there. And so the last couple years of my life have been dedicated to training that team, you know, moving into more of a mentorship and leadership and editor type role. And writing this cookbook was a huge opportunity for me to step back a little bit and work on a different kind of project, exercise a different part of my brain. So I'm thinking a lot about the future and what does that mean for me, and where I'll go. And I don't really have the answer to that, but I don't, but I'm open to the question. And I don't think that, you know, just being a chef that's in their restaurant every night is something that is sustainable for a lifetime. I think it's important to, you know, I have a 16-year-old daughter, so I only have a few years left to spend with her, at home anyway. And I, you know, sacrificed a lot of time with her in the beginning of my career. I was a single parent running a restaurant. So I had a lot of help from some really awesome, you know, community and nannies and things like that. And at this point, it's sort of like looking at how to create balance, because I think our industry in particular is not filled with people who are balanced and calm, and, you know, that's filled with people that have certain anxiety disorders and sometimes some substance issues and things like that. And I'm just really committed to having, you know, a healthy and clean lifestyle.
Naomi, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Chef Naomi Pomeroy talking about her cookbook, Taste and Technique. And that's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the KBOO website at kboo.fm.
I want to thank our guests, John Burt, Tanya Hayworth, Marisha Auerbach, and Naomi Pomeroy for being on today's show. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again next year on the third Wednesday of January for another episode of The Food Show. Enjoy the holidays, share good food with good people, and be safe. Until next time, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.